I thought maybe it would be good to start with a little bit of the history of this place, because it has been in your family for a considerable amount of time. And then what I'd like to do is for you to give me a thumbnail sketch of Warren as well, and the, you know, the changes over the years.
How long a time do you have you allotted to this?
We got all night.
Take quite a while to enumerate all of the changes. No, I was born here and never knew enough to get away. My grandfather moved here from beyond Prickly in 1896. I think it was March 19th, I think. I've heard my mother tell that when they moved up here, the snow was so deep that they couldn't go up the main road. And they had a horse road up across the field from the lower place, and where Tom lives. They came across the field and up, but below the mailbox where it is now, the road had eroded to the point that the bank on the south side, which was side the wind usually blew, was 4 or 5 feet high, and you just kept crowding off, and you eventually get off the road completely. So it's easier to make a new road, and nobody cared. So they came across up here, and then they went down our driveway, and they had another way to get around the cut that's above the house here. In fact, you can still see the mark up in the pasture where some of the old timers prepared it for winter road. There's a furrow plot up one side, and it leveled off. And that was the way our neighbors got up to their place. But they moved here in 1896 in March, which is almost 97 years. I think we're lacking a few days of being 97 years ago they came here. It coincided with my uncle's 21st birthday or thereabouts. I suspect it was an effort by my grandfather to keep the boy to home. I rather suspect that. No research or projection could ever tell you he did, but that was the effort, and he worked for, I think, a few months up to Barrie. Then he came home here and took over the farm, and they apparently left things about as they were until about 1900, and then they began to make improvements and changes. And one of the pictures that is taken, I think Kit Harrison used it in her book, that shows looking up from down below here, and there's another one looking down from up in back. It shows it right after they did the renovation, which it was quite considerable. They built 40 feet more on the end of the barn, which was actually an old New England barn with a roof on the way that it usually wasn't, but it was hand-hewed timbers, and they just extended the 30 by 40 foot barn, so the barn eventually came out about 40 by 70, and it's still there. They redid the house to some extent. I don't know just what they did to it. They built the addition on, I call it the old kitchen, but a long time it was a kitchen. They did considerable work on that. It was a shed to begin with, I guess. And there was a door that went out the back as well as out the front. But I only remember their telling me how it was, and well, it's still a little vague. And in 1901, they put in the pipe from the spring up. The spring is up on the hill, and they came down as far as the road with 3/4-inch iron pipe in 1901. And in 1902, they started again, and they came the rest of the way into the house. And the water ran here in a 35-gallon crock, I think it was. It was out in the kitchen, typical farm kitchen. It was We always called it the water barrel. And that teed off the 3/4-inch line in the cellar with a valve to create pressure enough in the house here to get a flow of water. I remember as a kid they used to, my uncle would be downstairs turning the valve, and my grandmother, my grandfather, and my mother would up here and holler down to him how much more to turn it so they would get the right amount of water running out of the 3/8 lead pipe, I think it was, and that the water came up. The lead pipe was quite prevalent at that time. It probably explains my lack of mental development. I drank water out of that lead pipe. I can never forgive him for that either. I'm not sure the rest of the world would. And then the water ran into a stock tank out here in the barnyard. I understand that the priority was to water the animals. Getting water to the house was secondary. If you didn't have water enough in the house, you go out to the water trough, as they called it, and get a pail of water. That was the only use we had for water was washing vegetables and drinking, washing dishes, and washing my hand in the old black sink.
How many cows at that point? Did you have cows?
Yeah, they came.
I'm picking up a lot of this noise. So
watch it.
Your hands.
Watch it. Okay.
So, yeah. Tape them to your stick them in your pocket,
sir.
No,
I'm sorry about that. I'll try to do better. I don't promise I will, but I'll try. If I don't, you come in and chew me out again.
Yep. Will do.
I can't talk without waving my hands. Well, I think I can restrain them to that extent. But I don't know. I think when they came, they probably had a few cows on the farm, and they likely brought some with them. Actually, my grandfather had the old subsistence farm up on the hill where you had 3 or 4 cows, an ox or two, maybe a driving horse, pigs, sheep. They had everything that they needed for existence. He raised his potatoes. He raised their own grain. He had a big vegetable garden, and sugared. Really wasn't much more you needed. He did sell a few logs. They cut off the land and skid it down with old ox probably. Sugared a little. That was sold, and of course everybody had hands. I remember my mother always used to figure on having 25 hands. She'd get 25 to begin with. Either they set the hen, and the old hen stole the nest and came out with some, but they tried to maintain 20 to 25 hens, which gave them all the eggs they needed for the home use and a few to sell, barter. So it was actually we were self-sufficient, which as I can best determine that was the typical way of living in Vermont at that time. When they came down here, they went more for specializing. They got a few more cows. I guess they bought a bigger horse, bigger horses, a pair of what we used to call Western horses. They had a driving horse. My grandfather wasn't big on driving horse. He always allowed they were more of a nuisance. They were good. If you want to go any place, you go ahead and walk. He didn't have to put up his horse when he got there. He didn't have to get the horse ready before he went. He tells a story of walking to Bolton from up behind Prickley where they lived, and helping his father-in-law hay in the afternoon. That made a good long day. But I've heard that rumor that he got up at daylight and walked to Bolton. They lived at the foot of Honey Hollow. On what's now the Lafreniere Farm.
Which is about how many miles?
I have no idea. It's probably 25 miles. And I don't think it's any less than that. So that was. But in fact, he went for walking in a great way. He couldn't be bothered with messing with a horse. He wanted to go to the village. He'd walk over the hill, and I think he died when he was 86, almost 87, and he'd walk down the village to church that summer before, right up over the hill and down. And he helped on the farm, pretty much the same as he always had, a little slower probably, but. Perhaps that was why he lived so long, I don't know, but he's always been very active, very slim, tall. Angular man, I guess you'd say. My grandmother was a short, stocky lady. I remember both of them. It amazes me as I stop to think that he was born in 1839. I was 80. He was 80 years old when I was born. And to think that I knew him for 6 years. He used to tell the kid a lot of things he used to do when he was a boy, and as I think about it, to imagine that I have talked with a man who was born in 1839, the country was young then. I don't know who was president. I haven't looked up, but there hadn't been very many. And my grandmother grew up down there at the foot of the Honey Hollow. I've heard her tell about when she was a girl at home, she had to go up and turn the cheeses and grease them every day. They had racks up in the cheese room up over the kitchen, and it was a girl's job to go up every day and smear tallow on the cheeses and turn them over. That was the job the girls did. I've heard my mother tell the story that I don't think I remember my grandmother telling it, but when she was a girl at home, probably she was born 1845, she likely was 10 years old. Her father went down to Richmond and bought a coal oil lamp, the newest thing out. Just an old kerosene light as we look at it now, but they were accustomed to using tallow candles that were made out of tallow that they tried out of their own beef or mutton or whatever. And she was afraid of that. That was a dangerous contraption. That coal oil, she didn't trust it, and her mother wouldn't have a thing to do with it. So she had to help her father trim the light and light it. I know if her mother would wash the chimney or not. I know my grandmother always used to object to washing a kerosene lamp chimney. She said the best thing to do that was with a newspaper. Wipe it out with a newspaper, it would shine. Well, there's one up there. It doesn't shine, but I guess I didn't wipe it out with a newspaper. But that was I can remember as a kid, she would always do that. And the lanterns were the same way. Of course, we had the old kerosene lantern that we carried to the barn. And if she wanted a globe cleaned up, she would polish it with a newspaper. I can neither recommend or condemn it, but that's I wouldn't dispute her either. Of course, little kids don't dispute their grandmothers.
Well, it must have been something else having to.
Whoop. That'll do it again.
Give me a break. I was asking about milking and so forth with just lanterns. What was it like growing up on the farm when you were small?
Well, we didn't get electricity here until 1946. We had the carbide gas lights. I think we put them in 39, which were, well, an improvement, considerable improvement. But I spent a good many hours sitting under a cow with a kerosene lantern hanging up on a post in the barn. And I am not sure, but there is a post down there in the barn now with a nail in it where we used to hang the lantern. No, everywhere we went, you took a lantern with you. Which shouldn't do this here now, but tell the old farmer that was kidding his hired man because he wanted to borrow his lantern to go courting. The old man said, "Oh, you're a coward." He said, "Don't I want courting? I never took a lantern with me." The man said, "Yes, and look what you got." So.
You had a phrase when I came in here that I liked, and I'd love you to use it in context about the pigs. You know, throwing a...
Oh?
The pig squeal the loudest when you throw.
Mm-hmm. Well, it went with the man who was complaining that the law enforcement was too hard on him. And they were sorting him out. He'd been used badly. Discriminated against in order to sort of soften the blow and defend myself. I reminded him that if you throw a stone into a herd of hogs, the one that squeals is probably the one that got hit.
Okay, tell me a little bit more about growing up. What I'm trying to get at is a description of how it was and then eventually how it is today.
Well, I think this time of year we probably more conscious of it. The school vacation had nothing to do with Easter. That doesn't mean that the people in town weren't Christian. But Easter had nothing to do with it. It was the weather. The boys all were expected to help their parents in sugaring. They rolled the roads, and there would be a buildup of 3, maybe 4 feet of snow in some places in the road, and they just roll it over and pack it down. You walk on top of it. I've had that experience with a path out here in the front yard. Sometimes I don't shovel it. I walk on the top and I discover that the path is higher than the rest of the snow is when it begins to thaw a little. But as soon as the breakup came, that was the word they used, as soon as the breakup came, you were in. You couldn't get out. You couldn't get out with the team. Try to drive a horse on that soft snow. They'd go in into the bellies, they used to say. And it wasn't easy walking on it for humans. And so there would be a time when you couldn't get to school if you wanted to. And it was left up to school directors to determine when the chagrin vacation started, usually 4 or 5 weeks. But when it broke up in the spring, so the chagrin was about to begin, and you couldn't possibly get out anyway, that's when the chagrin vacation started. And as we moved away from the agricultural period, it coincided with Easter, and they had the Easter vacation. In fact, I went to school at Montpelier during this period between 33 and 36, and I was amazed that they called it Easter vacation up there. So far as I was concerned, it was sugaring vacation. We got 3 weeks of Easter. Fairly got cheated a little on that. We usually got 4 or 5. But by the time you got back, the mud would be pretty well dried up. It'd be tolerable. You could get through, no problem. I can remember probably when I was 7 or 8 years old, we used to have in the wintertime take the milk down to the truck down at what we call the guide board. It's the three corners or the end of Plunkton Road now, I guess would best describe it. I couldn't lift a can of milk. My uncle was blind. He couldn't see to drive the horse. So we were a team. He would load up the sled and the milk cans there. I think a can would hold 10 gallons. That would be about 85 pounds. And the can itself weighed 27 pounds. So you had quite a sizable lift for a little kid. So he would go with me. I would drive the horse. When he got down, place to unload it, he'd take the milk out, set it on the ground then. The truck would come and get it. We'd pick up the three cans that we'd taken down the day before. Well, no, we had the can one day. There was one waiting for us, and there was one on the truck. So we had to have 9 cans So he put the cans back in the sled, or the old buggy, our old express wagon. Yeah, express wagon they refer to as, the pickup equivalent of a buggy. A little space behind the seat, designed purpose to carry loads, probably set back there 4 feet behind the seat. Whereas a buggy, you only had, well, a couple anyway. In fact, that same express wagon is over to Shelburne now. A good friend of mine bought himself a horse, and he wanted to live the old-fashioned way. He lives out on Shelburne Point, right across the road from Marina. There, you go down to the end of the road and turn right, and you go into Shelburne Shipyards, and you keep going to the left and through a little gate, and you come to Radkin's place. Very interesting, an awfully nice fellow, but he chooses to lead a different life, less restricted. I laughed at him a little. He bought himself a horse, old Bonesy, and he wanted to get the wagon so he could draw his produce up to streets of Shelburne and sell it at the market. And I had no problem. He was there in the barn, had sat there since sometime in the 30s, and Radkin got old bones in. He used to take his vegetables up there, and I accused him. I wanted to get it, take the girls to ride, but he never gave me a good answer on that either. But you get the feeling sorry for old Bonesy, because he didn't have any company. So then he went and he bought a couple of cows, keep Bonesy company. Well, then he overdid it. He had to he had to cut some hay for it. So he had to buy a tractor to cut the hay to keep the horse. And after he got the tractor, he had to have the mowing machine and the rake and the baler, all of which he added to his expense, and he had to buy himself a truck to ride in on. And he had to build himself a barn to keep him all in. One thing leads to another. And that, you know, we laugh at that. But that comes very close to the way that agriculture grows. I can remember here when we had just a pair of horses. We got along just fine. Had an old one-lung gas engine for power to run the corn chopper and the threshing machine and the saw rig. Like I wish I had it now. I have this thing with old gas engine. You might have seen this one sitting out here in the yard. It belongs to the gas engine club. But life was relatively simple. You had 10 or a dozen cows. What one man could handle very nicely, one man could milk them very nicely. Not handy if you get the boy to help you, but it's all right. It was still possible. And then it seemed like it would be easier farming if we had a tractor. So we went and bought a tractor. That means we had to have more hay, had to raise some corn for silage, a little more corn. In order to support the tractor, you've got to have two or three more cows anyway. You can't get away with anything less. So then after you get the tractor, you need a bigger set of plows, you need a bigger set of harrows, you need another rubber-tired wagon to go with it. Then if you're going to raise more corn, you need a corn harvester. And if you're going to have the corn harvester, you need a blower to blow it into the silo. And after you get all that, you discover you're in debt a little, so you got to do more. You get so you're just as far behind as you were in the first place. And I've seen this go right up through to the point of having 50 or 60 cows, four tractors, forage harvester, baler, bale carrier. And all the improvements we had, didn't live any better than you did before. You spend most of your time worrying about the overhead and paying a salary to the banker that you'd taken in as a partner. And don't kid yourself. When you start to expand more than you can pay for out of current income, you have taken on the bank as a partner. And they get paid. That's like I've heard them tell in the old mills. They said that a man with any money going into a business in a mill or something could be fairly sure that no matter what the partner he took on was going to take a living out of whether he contributed anything or not. So they warned anybody if they be sure their partner was going to pull his weight, because he was going to live on it anyway. But we were just as happy then growing up. We didn't know what lay ahead. Good thing, I guess. It was good. I look back on it. I think of a lot of good times I had. I went courted my wife on snowshoes. They said the roads were impassable. She lived down, she was boarding down, down at the foot of, top of Pike Hill, where the two houses, one across the road from the other. I think Richard Frederick lived there now. She taught school up to East Warren and boarded down there. And no way I'd get a car through. They didn't plow the roads then in 37, 38. So I went courting on snowshoes. I didn't thank a landowner when I came out all right anyway. And I was telling that same thing to a man who lives in on the same same area. I think his name is Hal Geiger. He came from Wisconsin, and we were exchanging interesting tales. Did you know? I did the same thing, only I went on skis. She lived in the farm up up above our place. But they didn't start plowing the road here until, well, the late 30s. They plowed with a horse. They had a pair of sleds with a, well, with a plow, if you will, and a wing on it, so they could make one track that you could get through. If you're going to meet anybody, you had to range for quite a ways ahead of time. And I think in 1940, the town bought a crawler tractor with a plow on it. And that was the first step blowing snow. They used that for probably 10 years or so, and then they got a big four-wheel drive truck, and they used that for a while. But up until 38, 39, or 40, the roads were not plowed. I started driving a car in 1935. My uncle couldn't see to drive, and he liked to go places. When the boy became 16, he, not through generosity, but through his own desires, he bought a car, and the boy could sometimes borrow it when he didn't want to go. So I look back on it now, I think how things have changed, and then you stop and think they really haven't changed that much either. I think in 36 he bought a 1936 Chevrolet sedan. Previous to that, he bought a 33, but I think it was $672 he paid for that Chevrolet sedan. And when I was going to school, I Montpelier, they had a work program. Sometimes I could find a little work spading gardens or sifting ashes. That's something you don't hear of much more now, but sifting the clinkers out of the ashes. 25 cents an hour. I could go down here to Roy Long's, where the Warren store is now, and you could get 6 gallons of gas for a dollar. Then you go down to Kerosene Joe Buskey's. You could get the Richfield gasoline, which was a little lower grade. I guess we called it the bootleg gasoline. And the old Chevy, when you tried to pull bike heel here, would, if you pulled it down, it would knock a little, but it was cheaper. But I had to work 4 hours to get that dollar to buy either 6 or 7 gallons of gas. And now the kids that are out speeding guards now, if any of them are, I think it's probably working McDonald's now, but they can buy more gasoline for 4 hours work than I could. So, actually, nothing has changed. They just put a zero on the end of everything. And that isn't too bad an estimate of how much things used to cost either. When somebody tells you how cheap they were, just put another zero on, you get it up to today's money. I don't know how long it'll be before you have to put two of them on, but worry about that.
Now, I think you told me in the past, and I'd love you to describe it again. East Warren was originally bigger than Warren, and explain how it was then that Warren became more the center of.
Well, of course, East Warren was on the old county road. And I got into a flap with the town historian about where the old county road used to go. But the county road came through East Warren and right out over the hill to Granville, down through to what we call a hill road to Granville, to Hancock. Interestingly enough, went to Lord's Tavern in Hancock, which was on the county road that, or toll road that was, I think, a year or two before that, had been set up by legislature to get from Middlebury to over the mountain to Woodstock. You probably run across that. But the legislature in 1805, I think it was, authorized a survey of a road from the mouth of Mad River to Lord's Tavern in Hancock. And I got that information from the library in Montpelier. It was at, I think, 2 o'clock in the afternoon on the 8th day of November in 1805. But the survey was done in 1807. And it is a complete record of the survey. It's in Book 1 in the town of Warren. And Waitsfield has the same one. I didn't go to Moortown. I was satisfied that it was all the same. And I scaled it off as best I could with my crude way of scaling and drawing. But interestingly enough, when I got on the same scale as the topo maps, I transferred it onto a piece of plastic and laid it on the topo map. And you can follow it right through from, I only went as far as the height of land in Granville yet. I'm going farther someday, but that satisfied my curiosity. And it tells about coming up through Moortown. It went on the backside of what we call the backside of the river. It came up to where the power dam is now, and then it followed on the backside of the river across from Austin's. There is a house across the bridge, and that same on the same road, I would presume, as you come up another mile or so, and the road comes out by the new bridge they just put in. Then it falls up through. You can see where they zigzag to go through between the ledges in Moortown. Then it goes up through over the back road, comes to the Moortown-Waitsfield town line. Tells about going to a man's barn there. It tells about going through at the church in Waitsfield. The church in Waitsfield is referred to as the church up on the common, which was very close to where the cemetery is now. That was one of the mile markers. And they came right through over the Commons Road. And as you watch the survey, when they came to the big dip by Broadwell's, you can see why they only went just a short distance each time. They went by the level, and you can see they went short distances. They couldn't go, and then you get on a level, and they'd go for a long ways. But they went down and up, and it you can follow it almost exactly, and that it went through the East Warren Four Corners. Then it goes up through here and out over the hill, and I went as far as the height of land. And they mentioned it out here where Blueberry Lake is. Mile marker 18, I guess we call it mile marker. They call it mile 18. They put in their stake, and I don't know what they did, but it was the 18 mile stake. It said it was in a Beaver Meadow, which we remember as Gold Swamp up there. But I accosted our town historian that I didn't believe the theory that the county road went over and under the mountain, and I think I have the map to prove it. Of course, I'm about in the same fix. It was an old fellow, Mr. Whitcomb, lived down here on what we call a Whitcomb farm now. And he contended the world was flat, and he had the map to prove it. So I'm about the same situation he was. However, I think my map is a little more accurate than his was.
But East Warren then was...
We were the center of town. Nothing had been happening. Well, this was the agricultural area, and this was where everybody traveled. It wasn't until they needed power, the Industrial Revolution, I guess you would say, that people lived down there and made use of the water. There were four dams down there in the village. I got a picture of Warren Village taken from the west side, just above where the Route 100 relocated road is, and it shows the village, the house beside the post office was right adjacent to a dam. You can't see the dam, but you can see the reflection of the building in the pond. And I'm particularly enthused about that because I have been telling people, our town historians and others, she contended there never was a bandstand down there. And I know, as a little kid, I saw one. That was before my mind got filled up with unessential details. There was room for that in limited space. But I have got a picture of that bandstand. But it's an extremely good picture of the town of Warren, and the house that's beside the post office now, the one with the mansard roof, it shows that in its original state as a barn, across from the old Warren, Carol Lippincott's apartments. It used to be the old Warren or Vermont store, Freeman's store previous to that. I knew it as Will Freeman's store. It was one of the places where my uncle would go and sit there and visit, and I thought one of the greatest experiences in the world to go down there and sit and listen to the men tell their stories. Of course, the old timers are all gone.
Why was that such a great experience? I've heard other people say that, but what made that?
You were a man among men. You grew up a little when you can sit in the company of your peers and listen to stories that of their accomplishments. That's the only thing I can think of. But it was an interesting thing for a kid. Didn't get there very often, but they would sit around the old stove and smoke cigars and chew tobacco and tell the yarns and things. Not necessarily the type of yarns that, like you would hear on television, but they were things they had done, the accomplishments, the way things used to be. Frightening thought. I started to say that. But there were a lot of fellows come down there that you didn't have television to watch. In fact, I think it's an improvement over television, but you could come down and, well, just a gathering of social plays. I remember the old squire on WDEV, he was telling of all the old characters that used to be around town. He felt sorry that the young people growing up didn't have that privilege of meeting the old timers. And then the last line, well, perhaps they do. And I've done my best to preserve that situation.
I want to also ask you to tell me the story of the Yellow Painted Hack, because I think we're going to be able to get Earl to sing some of that.
You've got the words to it.
Yeah, and I gave him those, and he had remembered bits of it as well. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking it might be nice to sort of have an explanation of the song.
Well, it originated, I think the school up here in East Warren was built in 1896 and 1898. And as all school building projects go, it ran over a little. I think they cost them $1,100 to build that with volunteer labor they had. And the town appropriated $1,000 to build a schoolhouse, two-story schoolhouse. And I think the final bill was around $1,100. Caused some consternation by people who didn't want to do it in the first place. The original school was across the road, just north of the Campbell House, and there's a picture donated by Rudolph Elliott in the Valley Reporter this week that shows the old Campbell House. And I think it's almost exactly where the telephone booth is. Well, so that happens to people who don't mind their own business.
So anyway, this school was...
The old schoolhouse was just north of that, about where the telephone boxes are now toward Thelma Ricketts place. Until DeFreeze cleaned up the field and pushed the stones out, you could see the foundation of the old schoolhouse. And I heard Frank Lovett tell about going to school up there. Said the sun would shine in under the door. It was loose, I guess. But they built a new schoolhouse anyway, and that building was taken down. What was done with it, I don't know. But as a result of all the complaints about how much it cost him, and somebody get their finger in the till. This is Molly got puppy food. Would you want to throw her out?
No, that's okay. Go ahead. So somebody had their...
There was Wilson Averill, one of the school board members. And there was Aaron Estee, who lived in a little house right beside the schoolhouse. And there was another... He had a brother... I believe, but they one Sunday morning early, Biddy Egan and Alden Foley. Biddy Egan lived over on the Seno Road now, about where the Goodfellow House is. And Alden Foley was another good old Irishman that lived up on Cider Hill. Walt Vredenberg, that was a great uncle of mine. He married my grandmother's sister. They lived somewhere on the corner there. One Sunday morning early, Biddy Egan, Alden Foley, Walt Vredenberg, old Tom was Tom Egan, Biddy Egan's husband. Old Tom and his dog Jack went tramping down the clover to look the schoolhouse over. They drove out around the schoolhouse by Aaron Estes' field. And as that goes along, whiskey they had no like. But it all originated from the flap about building the schoolhouse here in East Warren, where the East Warren Grocery is now. I have a remembrance. I couldn't understand it at the time, but now I can see it very plainly. At the same time, there was three or four characters, not old characters. They were just characters in Warren Village who were quite adept at poetry and music. One of them being J. Jess McAllister, who was the son of my grandfather's sister. Now, I'm not bragging about this. I'm not ashamed of it either. But, Art Hartshorn, which was Paul's great uncle, I guess. They wrote The Yellow Painted Hack, and there's a Riot and Warrens. He and Mrs. Lovett lived up above here, John and Ellen. And their daughter went down to school down here at the old Four Corners. In fact, they had two daughters, Luna and Grace. Well, the Lovetts were a little afraid that their daughter, Grace, was attracted to the schoolmaster, probably for good reason. However, she was the younger one of the two, and they thought it'd be much more appropriate if the older one would get close to him. So things didn't go their way, and they kept her home. Well, she got loose, and they locked her into a bedroom. Well, she got out, and she went down to the schoolhouse. She went down to school. Well, Ellen followed her down, and John was working on his mountain lot, cutting wood up on the mountain. Well, sent somebody up there to get him. They had a real riot. And it's recorded in the Riot of Warren, which is written in the same, which was my mother's handwriting. I didn't, until everybody was dead and gone who were close to that, I kind of kept it under guard. But it seemed like too much history to keep forever, so I allowed it to be seen again. But my mother remembered all this. She was in school the same at that time. She was one of the younger ones. But to get back to my original thing here, that one day Mr. and Mrs. Lovett came down by, and he had just painted his wagon. And wasn't too uncommon, a bright yellow for the wheels of a wagon was. He made it look real good in a black seat box. They drove in, and my grandmother had rather a sly sense of humor. She said to Mrs. Lovett, "You got the yellow painted hack." Everything was all quiet after that. Mrs. Lovett wouldn't have anything more to say. I couldn't understand why she was in such a tiff. She obviously was upset and mad. My grandmother eventually went back into the house, as I remember. But after I read that, I could read The Yellow Painted Hack and understood more of what happened. I could understand the incidents that I saw out here in the backyard that didn't make any sense to me at all at the time.
Now, do you think Mrs. Lovett had, some reason for being worried about the insinuation?
Eventually married him. Grace married him eventually.
No. The yellow painted hack. You said Mrs. Lovett was upset when your grandmother referred to the wagon she was in as the yellow painted hack. Was there any more to it than that?
Well, of course, they were both written to the same group.
And what I mean is, had Mrs. Lovett been involved in any graft or?
No. She was involved only in the dispute with the schoolmaster. They had a real riot, if you will. They had to call in the select man to quiet the melee, I guess. But the yellow-painted hack was referring to the other school up there, and it probably came about the same time. Maybe a little before, but the reference to that seemed to upset Mrs. Lovett. Mrs. Lovett had a quite a nose for news. She had a telephone, actually the only one I've known on this line, one of the candlestick phones, where you could set the thing on the table, and you could sit in the chair and hold the receiver. If you wanted to ring it, you had to get up and ring it on the box up there. But she had her binoculars and a picture window, the first picture window I ever happened to see, still up there in that house too. And she would sit up there, and every time the telephone rang, she would get the news. Party line, man, it was a live version of your soaps. But not too much to get away from. I can remember, now this pasture between here and there used to be all open over as far as the hardwood. The spruces, well, I have to admit that I was so lazy as to let the spruce grow in the pasture. Didn't seem too important to me, but I can remember Mrs. Lovett getting after my uncle because he was letting those trees grow up and she couldn't see down here anymore. It interfered with her view. We used to have a postman he would get here about noon, and often my mother would ask him in to have a hot dinner with us. And now and then my uncle would ask him if he wouldn't like a glass of cider, which of course wasn't the thing for a mail carrier to do, but as long as he didn't do it in excess, it wasn't anybody's business. However, she didn't feel that same way about it. She suspected what was happening. And he wouldn't be here more than 5 minutes before she'd call up and know if he's coming up. Now, if you can remember, as I probably was 9 or 10 years old, I went up there. My uncle sent me up on some errand from one neighbor to another, and I rapped on the door, and Mrs. Lovett came to the door, and I told her what the message was I had. And John, he was getting along in years, kind of inclined to go to sleep sometime after dinner, well, probably about my age. And he was deaf, and he had a rather unusual speaking to him. Most of them had a thing that went over the ear. But his was a long black tube with a mouthpiece on one end, a little thing on the other end, just sticking to his ear. Well, he was sitting there asleep probably when she started. She stuck that in his ear and told him what she had on her mind along with the news of the day.